Word of mouth.
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 This is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Taylor Quimby, sitting in for Virginia Prescott. If you've ever taken an online personality test, for fun or in earnest, you know to expect a barrage of questions about your habits, your feelings, your relationships. But researchers at Ohio State University recently discovered that testing for narcissism isn't all that complicated. There's only one question you really have to ask.
To what extent do you agree with this statement, "I am a narcissist"? Note, the word narcissist means egotistical, self-focused, and vain. One, not very true. Two, seven, very true.
So it's on a scale from one to seven.
Huh. This is hard. I would say at least a four. That's it! Thank you for your time taking this survey. Your response has been recorded.
That's it.
You chose four on the seven-point scale, which makes your narcissism score higher than 80% of the people who have taken this test. Although you are not a total narcissist, you did agree that you are a little bit narcissistic. However, I think that everyone who takes the test is lying.
That was Word of Mouth senior producer Maureen McMurray, who volunteered to take the single-item narcissism scale, or SINS. It's a one-question survey that measures levels of narcissism, but does not, I should point out, aim to diagnose people with narcissistic personality disorder. Brad Bushman is a professor of communication and psychology at Ohio State University's School of Communication. He helped develop and validate the single-item narcissism scale.
I think narcissism is bad for the individual, and it's bad for society. It's bad for the individual because if people already think they're great, then they don't try to improve themselves. And it's bad for society because if the only person you think about is yourself, then you're not very compassionate and caring to others. And other research we have done has shown that narcissism levels are increasing over time. In contrast, empathy levels are decreasing over time.
Now, that's kind of something that we've heard a lot about the millennial generation, that it's the most narcissistic age group that we've seen in a very long time. Do you think that's the case?
Yeah, definitely. Actually, we've done some research showing that that's true.
How accurate compared to the longer tests for narcissism is this single item narcissism survey?
It's very highly correlated with the 40 item version of narcissism. The disadvantage is it doesn't allow you to look at the various components of narcissism. There are several dimensions of narcissism, if you will. Narcissists, they're vain. They like to look at themselves in the mirror. They like to have authority over other people. They think they're superior to others. They have a sense of entitlement. And our scale doesn't allow you to look at these separate dimensions of narcissism. But if you just want a rough measure of narcissism in a study, for example, where you don't have a lot of time or it's very expensive to collect the data, it's much better to give a single item than nothing at all.
So what made you think this might work? You know, one day you were just handing out these longer 40-question surveys that people have been using in the past, and then you thought, you know, maybe we should just ask them.
Well, we thought narcissism is one of the few personality traits where you can actually just ask people if they're a narcissist and they will honestly tell you because they're not ashamed of it. They think they're special people who deserve special treatment. I could tell you an anecdotal example if it's a really funny one. I was on ABC News 2020 talking about this research, and one of our participants scored above the 90th percentile in narcissism and was behaving very aggressively by blasting his partner with loud noise and was actually laughing while he was doing it. And so I made an appointment with a student and I said, there's three things you should know. First of all, you think very highly of yourself. You were in the 99th percentile in narcissism. Second, you're actually laughing while you're blasting your partner with painful noise. And third, this show is going to be broadcast to 20 million people, and I don't want you to feel embarrassed about it. So if you want, maybe we can have them digitize your face. And the guy says, well, do you think they'll mention my name on national television? And I said, well, I hope not, but I don't think so. And he said, well, do you think they could give out my email too? So it was absolutely incredible. This guy was not at all embarrassed to be a narcissist or of the fact that he was behaving very aggressively against other people.
So that's kind of a crazy example of, you know, somebody who scores highly on the survey, and you can sort of see why. But if I can be totally honest, this is sort of an uncomfortable test to take. You know, I thought I was being honest about the fact that, okay, you know, yeah, I'm a little self-absorbed. And so I put a 4 on the 1 through 7 scale. And I was really shocked to find out that it said that I was, what was it? I'm 80% higher than all the other test takers. That seemed like a lot to me.
Yeah, well, we have our research. We did 11 studies involving 2,250 participants, and we have norms based on people's sex and their age. And so, you know, the score might differ depending on your sex and age. In general, males tend to have a little higher scores than females, mm-hmm. and younger people tend to have a little higher scores than older people do.
Can I venture to ask what you got in the survey?
What my score was?
Yeah.
It was 1.
Wow. So that's like absence of narcissism.
Well, yeah. It's as low as you can get.
The highly selfless Brad Bushman is a professor of communication and psychology at Ohio State University's School of Communication. If you'd like to take the single-item narcissism scale or send it to one of your confident friends, there is a link at wordofmouthradio.org. And we'll be staying on the personality tip. Up next, how to cultivate a healthy sense of self-worth in the age of the selfie. That's coming up after a break. This is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Taylor Quimby, sitting in for Virginia Prescott. Of the many words of the moment, narcissism seems to be grabbing the spotlight, which it would, if you think about it. A simple Google News search will result in hundreds of headlines like Kim Kardashian, Queen of Narcissism, A Little Narcissism Never Hurt Anyone, and Study Finds That Narcissistic CEOs Have the Highest Salaries. But do these headlines indicate that we've become more narcissistic as a society, or are we using the word incorrectly? And what really separates a healthy dose of confidence from excessive conceit? Philosopher and professor Simon Blackburn ponders the nature of self-worth and how it has evolved over the centuries in Know Thy Selfie, an essay we found at eon.com. Here he is speaking with Virginia Prescott.
The question of proper self-regard is one philosophers have been considering for some time, but therein lies the rub. It is the self pondering the self. Can that ever be accurate?
Well, it's a very good question. And, you know, as long as it's been asked, there has been a drumbeat of, you know, self-deception, the idea that we somehow put veils in front of ourselves. We don't appreciate our true selves. Famously, the poet Burns said, would some gift, if only we could have the gift to see ourselves as others see us. And equally, quite a lot of religious thinkers, especially, have thought you need a dark night of introspection. You need 40 days in the wilderness to come to terms with who you are. So we're not as transparent to ourselves as you might at first sight think.
How did that notion of knowing thyself evolve over the ages?
Well, I think it began to get a definite Christian flavor, of course. I think part of the extraordinary allure of the monastic tradition was the idea that it was in solitude, it was in withdrawal from other people, that you could best come to terms with yourself. I'm not sure that's true. I think the mirror is a very revealing instrument, and other people are mirrors to each other. Mm. I can learn who I am quite well by listening to other people, talking to other people, finding what they think about me, finding how I stand in the eyes of others. So yes. Solitude is not necessarily the answer, I think.
That seems to be part of the aim, at least in contemporary education and parenting, you know, putting kids inside of a room full of others and reinforcing self-esteem in children. What are the historical origins of self-esteem, and when did that become a goal?
Yeah. I don't think it became a goal until really quite recently. I looked at the British Library catalogue, which is the equivalent, I suppose, of the Library of Congress catalogue in the United States. And from about 1850, I think the first book with self-esteem as a either a part of the title or part of the indexed content was written about 1850. And then until about 1960, there were very few. But since 1960, there's been certainly over 10,000, I think it was over 11,000 books with self-esteem as a principal topic. So I think we're looking at a very steeply ascending graph here.
And that goal of educating children with self-esteem has been, accurately or not, linked to a generation of kids who feel entitled to whatever they want or need in the world, vanity, always needing approbation. All of this gets kind of tossed into this idea of the culture of narcissism. Is that accurate to throw it all in together?
Well, I don't think it is. I mean, there are distinctions to be made. I think a proper self, the root notion of a self, of an esteem is of an estimate. It's the idea of an estimate. So self-esteem should be having an estimate of yourself. And as with most things, estimates are better when they're reasonably accurate. If you overestimate yourself, you'll undertake things which could be disastrous. You might literally be riding for a fall if you overestimate your capacities as a horseman or as a rock climber. If you underestimate yourself, then of course you won't profit from opportunities you could have taken. You would be too shy or too modest to do things which you might have done very well. So you'd expect that the right thing would be, as so often, to find the mean, to find a judgment of yourself which is reasonably accurate. But this doesn't seem to be how it plays out in educational circles. I mean, parents are made to feel terribly guilty about damaging their child's self-esteem, as if it was a sort of warm bath and the more of it you got, the better. I think that's a terrible mistake myself.
When you say something about the mean, you can't be too showy or considered crass. You can't play too small or you'll be stepped over. That's right. Always in comparison to others. But can we ever be truly free of that comparison?
Well, the philosopher who thought we could was Jean-Jacques Rousseau, the French philosopher, 18th century French philosopher. He sort of had a campaign, a long-standing campaign against what he called amour propre. And amour propre was essentially comparative. It was the appreciation or the concern for your standing in the eyes of others and your place in the pecking order. And he thought that was a really bad thing, and the key to a good life, the educational key, which he, in his tracts on education, he recommended, was going to be to get rid of amour propre. Just don't concern yourself with these issues of status and vanity and harvesting the good opinion of other people. Just go about earning your living and keeping body and soul together, and you'll be much, much happier. I think there's something in that, but again, it can be overdone, because an awareness of our relationship with other people is not always a bad thing, and that relationship will include things where we know that we are not very good, things where we know that we are slightly better than other people. And it's very hard to imagine human life being rounded or full if you get rid of all of that. So once again, I think there's a kind of simplicity about Rousseau's nostrum, Rousseau's medicine for the soul. And that's something that I enjoy talking about in the book as well.
We're talking with the philosopher and writer Simon Blackburn, who ponders the nature of self-regard and asks, can we cultivate self-worth without the vanity of self-love? Those are among some of the questions he considers in an article called Know Thy Selfie. Well, Simon Blackburn, we have mapped the neural pathways of the brain, right? But we have never yet located the self. So we need people to reflect back on us, upon us, who we are. Do you think that's the motivation behind the selfie?
It's hard to say. I mean, I think very often the motivation behind the selfie naturally arises from the nature of modern society. In a more restricted sort of village societies, Everybody knows who everybody is. There's no need to parade it. There's no need to try and put your elbows out and shove your way to the front. In fact, that would be frowned upon. In modern urban society, and especially societies extended by means of social media networks and so on, finding an identity, making sure other people know who you are, is much harder. You don't want to be an anonymous face in a crowd. So I'm actually not a moralist. I'm not moralistic about teenagers slightly obsessively posting selfies. I mean, they're only a nuisance to each other. They're not a nuisance to me, except when they stand in art galleries and do it. So I'm not too worried about that. I think Know Thy Selfie was a cute title, but I'm not down on the teenage habit of telling everybody what they're having for breakfast and showing everybody what it looks like when they clean their teeth and so on.
Well, you're not moralizing, but when I saw selfies taken with the California wildfires in the background, for example,
yes,
or car accidents, I was pretty mortified. So this has become sort of acceptable behavior in some circles anyway. Does that fit into this idea of the culture of narcissism? Or again, is that just getting thrown around too much?
I think there is certainly an element of narcissism. Obviously, if somebody thinks that the most important thing about a Californian fire is that they were there looking at it, or they were there standing in front of it, then something's gone wrong with their values. I think that's perfectly true. On the other hand, I think the impetus to say that here was I somewhere interesting is quite deep. I think it's very notable, I'm sure, that there's statistics about this, that nearly everybody takes more photographs when they're on holiday than when they're just about their home business. And more photographs still if they're on holiday somewhere very exciting. If I go to Mount Everest, I'd love to have a selfie taken of me standing in front of a good picture of Mount Everest, or the Taj Mahal, or New York City, for that matter.
What do you think Rousseau would have thought of the selfie?
I think he'd have been pretty appalled at the selfie. Rousseau was a moralist. He was a much stricter moralist than me. And he seemed to be almost pathologically frightened of vanity. It's interesting that he himself had the thinnest of skins. He was... quite pathologically aware of what other people were thinking about him, about his standing in society. And of course, partly that's true of court life. If you're trying to make an impression on the people who matter at court, then of course you become, hypersensitive to slights and insults and even the smallest kind of setback or rebuff can seem like the end of your career. So I think it's a vice of politicians and courtiers that they become hypersensitive in this way. And Rousseau is very conscious of that in his own case and very anxious that nobody else should be like that.
So do you think we are in some kind of age of narcissism, or is this just another point in the evolution?
Well, I think full-blooded narcissism is actually quite rare. I think it's probably found through human history. There's certainly been monsters, tyrants, people who imposed their will on other people, people who had undue self-confidence, conceit, the inability to listen to others, and that goes along with things like pig-headedness and so on. And I think they're probably found throughout human history. Whether there are more of them now or fewer, I don't know. I think that in some respects, I think they're more. They certainly stalk boardrooms. One of the most amusing pages, I think, in my book is where I cite some psychological results showing that in the UK, at any rate, top CEOs as a group scored worse than the inmates of Broadmoor. Now, Broadmoor is the premier institution for the criminally insane, people who've committed crime but been judged insane by the courts. And it turns out the top business managers as a whole score much worse on personality disorder tests. than the inmates of Broadmoor. So that suggests that some things like this are on the... They're far too common. Whether they're on the rise or not, I don't know, but they're far too common.
Well, Simon Blackburn, what a pleasure speaking with you. Thank you so much for joining us.
Okay, thank you very much, Virginia.
Simon Blackburn, a philosopher and professor emeritus at Cambridge University. He's author of several books, most recently Mirror, Mirror, The Uses and Abuses of Self-Love. You can read his essay, Know Thy Selfie. We found it at aeon.com, and we have a link to it at wordofmouthradio.org.
It's film season in New Hampshire. Yep. You heard that correctly. Right now, location scouts are actually scouring our lakes and campgrounds for the picture-perfect backdrop for movies, TV shows, and commercials. We'll hear why New Hampshire has become a B-roll heaven when word of mouth continues.
Word of
mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Taylor Quimby, sitting in for Virginia Prescott. They are everywhere. We are surrounded by them. You're probably one yourself. Of all the relationships we have in modern society, the neighbor occupies a curious spot. As Sean Hurley writes, here in New Hampshire, we have our very own special kind of neighbor, and sometimes they have helicopters. Sean Hurley brings us this story.
Where we live, on a dead-end dirt road in the White Mountains, the house lights of our neighbors are mostly out with the sun. We have three sets of neighbors, older couples, their children grown and gone. It's mostly the men I see, in whose lives I know a bit, divided though we are by a river, by trees, by a great horse field. All through the summer, as early as possible, nearly every day, and no matter what, neighbor one mows his lawn. Retired now, with 5 acres to tend, one prefers to chip away at the grass an hour or so a day. On Monday, he slaloms the pines beside the river on a sit-down mower. On Tuesday, he jets across the horse field in a full-size tractor. At 6 a.m., neighbor two heads off to work in a big-bellied pickup, his left elbow locked in the open window. Sunglasses before sunup, great mustache like a black sheep on a cliff. His headlights scan our curtains as he turns down the road. He tiptoes his truck by us as quietly as he can. You hear more the tires crushing gravel than the grumble of engine. At the end of the day, if he sees me, he'll nod down over the wing of his elbow, as though I am a boy, as though he is passing high above me in a plane. Neighbor three lives on the river as we do. Excavators, bulldozers, cherry-pickers come and go on his land. He turns trees into neat cords of wood and streamlines the earth around his part of the river so it never floods. It took years for me to discover that he was also a race car driver, dirt tracks in the summer, ice ponds in the winter. Often the people you live closest to, you know the least. You take it slow with neighbors. While you've got all the time in the world, you don't have all the space. So you get to know them over the course of years and from a horizon of impressions. And the piecemeal story you put together about who they are is never right and never ends. Neighbor one, for example, stops mowing at 9 or 10. Exhausted, I suppose. He's reached his limit. I imagine him spent behind a checkered tablecloth, sipping lemonade, getting ready for tomorrow's rotten case of mildly tall grass. But then, I hear, he is a gardener, a green thumb, it is said. And on the far side of his yard, tipped from my view, he's brought up a stunning landscape. Rows of canoe paddle corn, huge red tomatoes inflate over polished curls of squash. The heart of his day is not lawn mowing, but a secret garden. There is no checkered tablecloth, no long lemonade ruminations. But this, I am learning, is what neighbors do best. Slowly, suddenly, they are someone else. The neighbor who lived in the house before neighbor one told me the moment he was leaving that his favorite thing in the world was hunting for a kind of extra wily goat on frozen mountains. Maybe, I reasoned, he meant the fast-hopping deer in the cold hills nearby. But in the very final moment we were neighbors, he dragged from his red barn the spectacular dragonfly of a helicopter, which is the thing about neighbors that's easy to forget. It doesn't happen often, but eventually there's a racing car. Suddenly, a secret garden. It could even be the very last moment when the helicopter comes flying out the red barn. But you can only go so long and be so blind to something so fantastic, so close, so far away. For Word of Mouth, I'm Sean Hurley.
We live up in New Hampshire. We don't have lawns, we have pastures. When we go outside, we use lanterns. It's pretty dark in New Hampshire. We went to the city, got blown away. Not a single pasture there anyway.
It's film season in New Hampshire. Yep, you heard that correctly. We'll hear why New Hampshire has become a B-roll heaven when Word of Mouth continues.
Don't have cars, we drive tractors. All in New Hampshire. In New Hampshire. All here in New Hampshire.
This is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Taylor Quimby, in for Virginia Prescott. Robin Williams' 1995 adventure movie Jumanji was filmed in part in downtown Keene and Swansea, New Hampshire. And after he passed away earlier this month, many of our listeners from the Monadnock region honored him by posting photos and memories of his visit on social media. Jumanji was something of a rarity, as very few major motion pictures have been filmed here in New Hampshire. But around this time every year, production companies flock to the Granite State to capture that classic New England look. Matt Newton is director of New Hampshire's film and TV office, and he joins me now. Hi, Matt.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So what are production companies looking for when they do come to New Hampshire? It's not something we hear about in the news all the time, but I know that they come.
They do. The range of projects, actually, it's a much bigger scene than just Hollywood. I mean, it's commercials, it's catalog photo shoots,
sure,
short films. It runs the gamut. It's funny, this time of year, August, September, are what I usually call my cabin by the lake months. The indie horror filmmakers start coming out of the woodwork looking for those isolated locations. A rustic cabin lake, you know, by a lake.
And, mm-hmm. Mountains and, in the distance.
Mountains in the distance,
sure.
That sort of thing. So I get a lot of calls this time of year. But everything works a few months ahead. So even if they're not looking to film just yet, I get a lot of location scouts coming into the state just wanting to become familiar with the lay of the land.
And maybe thinking ahead to October and November when the colors really start to come out.
Exactly. Even further out, I'll start seeing productions now for maybe next spring.
Oh, wow.
So they just kind of want to get a lay of the land, what lakes look good, what urban areas might work, whatever it calls for.
Do you have any examples, things that people might recognize on TV, whether it's a commercial or maybe even just one of those opening shots in a film that was New Hampshire and we just didn't realize that it was New Hampshire?
Mm-hmm. A good example is it was a very short-lived show on Fox called Goodwin Games, and this was just maybe a year or two ago. It was canceled quickly, but what people didn't realize is that the opening shot of this nice Victorian house in the fall was actually in Portsmouth, and there it is in the opening credits. And unfortunately, it didn't last. But a lot of times, they go unnoticed. You don't really realize that that was New Hampshire. We had a I believe it was a Mercedes commercial a few years back that shot up on U.S. Route 2,
mm-hmm.
North of the Notch. And it was a nationwide commercial. It was, I believe, aired during the Super Bowl at one point. And it was all the white birches that you come to see when you're driving that route. So, but no one would really know that. So
right,
it's sort of the little secret where—
It's just another car commercial.
It's just another car commercial. Again, a lot of these projects are smaller. There's a horror film called Yellow Brick Road that had a small play in theaters. They shot in the North Country, Pittsburgh, Lancaster, got a hold of a large piece of land up there. The property owner said, sure, have fun, and they made their horror film. Sensation of Sight was in Peterborough. That was in 2004.
Sure, Aaron Wiederspahn.
Yep. He also did a follow-up film called Only Daughter, which was in Claremont. Claremont's really interesting. They're becoming our little jewel, the backdrop of New Hampshire, and they get it. They're welcoming productions all the time, so hoping to bring more up there.
Now,
we sort of think of the film industry as being this big economic boom. Now, do we see maybe the sort of economic boost from these smaller projects that we might see from a major motion picture?
We see our share of it. Granted, the major motion pictures are going to other states right now, primarily because there's some sort of financial incentive involved. Mm-hmm. Massachusetts is a good example. However, we have been capitalizing more on the independent film sector of the industry, and that's good because I think if we're looking at New England as quote unquote Hollywood East, that's part of the market as well. So if we can do what we can to help these lower budget independent filmmakers, we'll do what we can. And there's economic impact from those as well. So I can say that over the last year, I've had about 200, just over 200 different types of projects, again, features to commercials, whatever,
right,
contact me. 45 of them have actually shot here, and it's resulted in a spend of just under $1 million. So
wow,
we do see a little piece of the action. Granted, I would like to see a little bit more of that.
And what about you know, bringing in New Hampshire workers? Is there any tie-in for people here in the state, mm-hmm, able to maybe help out or work on any of these projects?
There's always an opportunity. I post cast and crew notices on our website, Facebook, Twitter, that sort of thing. And we get the word out there. We do have a number of New Hampshire people who are union crew and work, whether it's in the state or in Massachusetts, on those larger projects I mentioned about. So as long as New Hampshire people are working, whether it's here or across the state line, that's fantastic. The question is, how can we bring more of the projects up into the state?
Now, I mentioned Jumanji in the introduction, mm-hmm, and I actually moved to Keene right after that movie was released. So I never got to see it when it was in production, but some of my classmates that I went with at Keene Middle School and Keene High School were actually in the movie, the beginning portion, yeah, where there's a, I don't know, the naughty kids who beat up the main character, Robin Williams, when he's a kid.
Yeah. I was actually a film student at Keene State College when that filmed, and I remember being down in the square for the big stampede. It was amazing to kind of get a glimpse of Hollywood production, and we've been working on our little short films and student films, so to see something this big. I remember everybody coming out for it, and it was like a circus almost.
Yeah.
Minus the animals.
Right, right. I read somebody in the Union Leader was quoted as saying that Robin Williams was sort of our celebrity because, yeah, of that. Now, I wonder, what other big movies have been made here in New Hampshire?
Not many big movies. I guess it goes back to 1980 on Golden Pond, mm-hmm, is still the only Hollywood film that was shot from beginning to end here in the state. So obviously we'd like to change that at some point. But independent films, I mean, the most recent production we've had was In Your Eyes, which was the Joss Whedon. He wrote it. He produced it. Didn't direct it. The director was Bryn Hill. But that was shot here just a couple years ago. And that was probably one of the larger independent films we've had that bounced all over the state.
Now, I've got a kind of weird question for you. Mm-hmm. But maybe a year back, I was watching this movie Admission, which was starring Paul Rudd and Tina Fey. And I don't know if you saw it, but in the film, there's a scene that's set at, quote, an experimental school in New Hampshire. Mm-hmm. And when I was watching the movie, I thought, oh, wow, I wonder where this was filmed. And of course, I went on to IMDb. I looked it up and it was filmed in New York. Sure. Now, do you have any idea why sometimes you would have a movie that might be set in a place, but they choose to film it somewhere else?
Today, it goes back to those financial incentives. Uh-huh. A number of the states, there's probably about 10 that don't right now, but the other states offer some sort of tax credit for film production, and that's luring a lot of the production into their states, and they can get a little bit of a money break, if you will. So a lot of times they'll take a look at the script and say, hey, this is what we're looking for the environment, these establishing shots. We can double it somewhere. You know, maybe we can double New Hampshire in North Carolina. I have a number of films on my list that people call up and want to know where they were filmed in New Hampshire when, in fact, they weren't even shot here. Mm. I mean, What About Bob is probably the most common one that I get. It's all about New Hampshire, looks like New Hampshire, shot in Virginia. And that had nothing to do with the finances of the film. It was more the time that they wanted to shoot the film. Our leaves had started to turn. And so they went south at a similar location where the leaves were still green because it's just early summer.
So how do you actively court the film industry, which I imagine that you try and do, to bring people to New Hampshire? I mean, what are you trying to sell about, you know, the location here that you might not be able to get anywhere else, knowing that The Man on the Mountain is no longer something that we can we can offer to viewers.
It's one of the biggest advantages I hear, particularly with commercial production and photo shoots, is that they can come to, say, Concord, and within an hour north, west, east, south, there are very diverse locations. They can get quickly up into the mountains and maybe the next day just scoot over to farmland or urban areas of the seacoast. So it's very easy in a week's time to move the company around without having making some huge move. It's challenging right now. Again, those tax credits are the big buzzword right now. We have a group called the New Hampshire Production Coalition that tried to put some legislation forth. It was quickly killed in the House. But they're back at the drawing board again, taking a look at this. But that's the challenge right now. How do we compete with other states that are providing this kind of incentive? And so we're hoping that we can kind of get back to our New England roots. And since we're dealing more with independent film, maybe there's a little Yankee ingenuity involved that we can do. Maybe we can open a few doors and help people get some things that they normally wouldn't get in other states. So,
like free maple syrup.
Free maple syrup. In Your Eyes is a good example. They actually came to us saying, we need a stretch of railroad. We're shooting with some freight cars. And we found them a 2-mile stretch of private railroad in Claremont, brought in the engine and about a dozen boxcars. It cost the production, but it would have been far more in another state, I like to believe. And it was, they truly appreciate that kind of help. And it's towns like Claremont, Manchester, Portsmouth, very film-friendly communities that we're hoping that will attract these productions.
Matt Newton is the director of the State of New Hampshire's Film and TV Office. Matt, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you so much.
If you'd like to learn even more about the Granite State's celluloid history, you can visit our website at wordofmouthradio.org, where you'll find this article, 9 Things You Didn't Know About Movie Making in New Hampshire. And we head to the sewers for our next film location. The Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles 1990 original opens with a decidedly 80s soundtrack and an ominous news report about a crime wave striking New York City.
Much more than just a series of small, isolated incidents, it's now apparent that an organized criminal element is at work. And at the moment, business is good.
As we later discover, a secret society of ninjas called the Foot Clan is orchestrating a very un-ninja-like series of muggings and robberies throughout the Big Apple. Now, the Turtles and the Foot Clan are back in Michael Bay's reboot of the franchise, but according to writer Adam Hofbauer, the differences between the two films offer a telling portrait of how our perceptions of crime have changed over the past 25 years. Adam, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Hello.
So let's remember the Foot Clan as depicted in that 1990 original. We're kind of looking at pickpockets and TV thieves dressed as ninjas, right?
We are, which is interesting in that they actually made a change from the original source material in which they were just typical ninjas. That was a change that was brought into the film independently of the original source material.
So you think they were really trying to play on the natural fears that people might have had in New York City about crime at the time?
I think it's a really interesting example of intentional fallacy, of maybe authors not really even being aware of what they were tapping into. It's really impossible to tell the full extent of something's relationship with its own time period until sometimes decades have gone by.
Now, the way it plays out in Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles is almost quaint. We've got one of the main characters, a teenager, is the son of another character. And, you know, he sort of gets wooed, I guess, by the Foot Clan. He gets appropriated into this sort of gang. And their lair is kind of like a skate park slash casino. You know, there's graffiti all over the walls and kids are playing video games and smoking cigarettes.
Yeah, it's what your grandmother would imagine if you had her imagine crime. Even today, they're playing arcade games and they're offered anything they can get. And the worst thing they can think of is to get some free cigarettes, especially in contrast with the recently released reboot. Based on trailers and plot descriptions, it looks to be that the Foot Clan has been updated from just some sort of nunchuck-wielding ninjas to something more resembling a terrorist organization. They walk around in high-tech gear, and instead of assaulting people on train platforms individually, sort of like muggers, they orchestrate what look like sort of large-scale terrorist incursions. Which brings up the irony in that the film from 1990, which was released at the height of crime, depicts crime in an even less intense manner.
Let's hear a quick clip from the trailer for that movie. This is Michael Bay's recent reboot of the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles.
Surveillance is showing heavy Foot Clan activity.
If they're taking hostages,
let's rock and roll.
So it's not just the Foot Clan that's changed from the 1990 version to now. You also talk about the Ninja Turtles themselves, that early in the 1990 version, they were sort of a product of a random accident. You know, they stumble upon this canister of green ooze. But today's Ninja Turtles are intentional. They've been engineered. Can you talk a little bit about why that might be?
I think that the reason that is because it appeals to an aspect of reality that fiction can tell us exists, even though it might not. So that if you actually look at the decline of crime rates, there's far too many possible reasons that no one really knows why crime declined, and no one can really expect what shape it will take in the future. And since reality is random and even chaotic to an extent, we compensate for that by making our fiction increasingly intentional.
And that works both ways. So, you know, the villains are kind of destiny villains, and the heroes are destined to, you know, appear and defeat them.
Of course, and it's much scarier to realize that the world is kind of rudderless.
Do you think other remakes and reboots, you know, films that are sometimes spanning, you know, two or three decades, they might give us, you know, really surprising windows into how cultural attitudes are evolving over time?
Well, I think this is something that the Ninja Turtles have recently sort of entered their... They were first created in 1984, so they are, I guess, 30 years old this year.
Yeah.
And they've entered a stage when they've pretty much been in pop culture in one form or the other pretty much for that entire time. Not always in films, not always on television, but in some form of merchandise or publishing. And that when something is around that long, it inevitably morphs and changes to reflect the culture that surrounds it. It might be one of the reasons why comic books are such a powerful cultural touchstone, because it's one of the few art forms that is consistently produced. There's been a Superman comic every month since the 1930s, and that's another great example of something that you can look at and really trace pop culture through the changes of these pop characters. And it's something that, given that the Ninja Turtles are far too valuable of a property for the people that have financial stakes in them to let them go pharaoh, we're going to probably see them change just as much as they continue to be ubiquitous, whether anyone's asking for them to be there or not.
Adam Hofbauer is a writer. His article on what the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles franchise can tell us about our own perceptions of crime appeared in The Atlantic, and there's a link at wordofmouthradio.org. Adam, thanks so much for joining me today.
Thank you for talking with me.
Go Ninja, go Ninja, go! Go Ninja, go Ninja, go!
Thanks for joining us today. Earlier in the show, we talked about films and TV shows shot in New Hampshire. Among the most well-known is Jumanji, which starred Robin Williams and was shot in Keene. Well, Keene is once again on the national stage, this time for a very different reason: police militarization. In 2012, Keene used a nearly $300,000 grant from the U.S. Department of Homeland Security to purchase a Bearcat, an 8-ton anti-terrorism vehicle. And it was recently thrust into the spotlight because of the protests in Ferguson, Missouri. John Oliver took aim at Keene in his HBO show Last Week Tonight.
Since 1996, in response to the war on drugs, the Department of Defense transferred $4.3 billion in military equipment to local and state police. After 9/11, the Department of Homeland Security made additional equipment available to local law enforcement through federal funds for terrorism prevention.
That's right. And this has happened on such a scale that it's enabled small towns like Keene, New Hampshire, to apply for a Bearcat, a military-grade armoured personnel truck, which they needed because, as their application argued, the terrorism threat is far-reaching and often unforeseen, and cited as a possible target their annual pumpkin festival. specifically, this pumpkin festival, which is now being protected by this. And good luck easily outmaneuvering that, teenagers with baseball bats.
John Oliver there, talking about Keene, New Hampshire's Bearcat. You can find that video on our website, wordofmouthradio.org.
It's always a little weird to see a small town from your state in the context of a national news story, so do check it out, pass it along to your friends. After all, even viral videos travel by word of mouth. I'm Taylor Quimby, sitting in for Virginia Prescott. Join us for more Word of Mouth tomorrow at 2 on New Hampshire Public Radio.
Word of Mouth is produced by
Taylor Quimby,
Logan Shannon,
and senior producer Maureen McMurray.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals
and not those of NHPR,
its board of trustees,
or its underwriters. Word of Mouth is a production
of New Hampshire Public Radio.